This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertz, our General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he is every show, is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, today we're getting together to record a memorial episode. It's something that I don't think we've done since Cliff Bohl passed away, probably here on The Orb, and this one is for Barry Jenner.
You know, Chris, it's always sad when we have to get together to talk about this kind of thing. You know, it was frustrating in some ways because I wish we didn't have to do these kind of episodes. You know, what's wonderful is getting to talk about somebody who, like so many of the characters on Deep Space Nine, we think of as larger than they were in the series. You know, I think a lot like Garrick, you think that Admiral Ross was in the show a lot more than he was. I think 12 episodes he's in, and that's really...
12 episodes, yeah.
So I think it's a testament to the writers, and I think it's a testament to the actors who portray these characters. And so, you know, to get to talk about him today, a little bit about his life, the work that he's done, it's a joy to be able to do that, and yet there's some serious sadness losing him because, man, this guy's just... His work was just so prolific. I mean, looking at the list right now, Chris, that you had put on the outline, I am astounded by the things that he was in. In fact, I can't find anything he wasn't in that wasn't popular. Like, I mean, it's incredible, the work that he did.
Well, I found one. I don't think he was ever on Murder, She Wrote.
Oh,
but
that would have, you know, clinched it, you know?
Yeah. Although we could play 6 Degrees of Angela Lansbury and maybe we could trace him back to her some way.
Oh, I'm sure that there are plenty of things that he's been in that you could trace more than half of the people in Hollywood these days. So, you know, it's pretty incredible.
But as we were joking on the other side of the orb, Jenner really was like the Jeffrey Combs of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, wasn't he?
Oh my gosh, no, you're exactly right. I mean, looking at this list, I mean, we're talking about Knots Landing, Remington Steele, V, Days of Our Lives, Highway to Heaven, that's right, the one with Michael Landon, good stuff right there, Dallas, St. Elsewhere, I mean, Family Ties, Matlock, Mr. Belvedere, Family Matters, and the list just keeps going and going, and it's just incredible. I mean, all the way up to, you know, being in, you know, in a show like JAG. So, I mean, it's just, it is pretty incredible the amount of places that he did show up. And how could I forget? The best of all of them, because Chuck Norris was on it, and we all know that nothing beats Chuck Norris. I mean, Walker, Texas Ranger.
Exactly. Yeah, he's known for a few specific shows, even though he was so prolific. His very first ever role was the one on Another World. He played a character named Evan Webster, 1976 to 1977. And that's where he really became active. So his active years in acting are really 1974, so a little bit before that. All the way through to 2016, I mean, he completed something called The Caretaker just this year. And then, of course, he passed away at the age of 75. But after Another World, Knots Landing, which you mentioned, he played Jeff Cunningham on that show in 1981. And then Dallas, from 84 to 86, he was Dr. Jerry Kenderson. And if I don't remember the specifics of it, but I believe his character was wrapped up in the whole who shot JR conspiracy or the plotting to shoot JR, something along those lines. I vaguely remember, although I actually did watch, I believe, almost all of Dallas because my grandmother and my uncle, I would go to their place on, well, not every weekend, but almost every other weekend growing up through middle school and on into high school. And they were big Dallas fans and Knots Landing as well.
Well, I mean, Dallas was one of those shows back then where it seemed like everybody was watching it. I mean, that was the show, you know, and I would say arguably had the biggest cliffhanger ever, which was who shot JR. I mean, I think, you know, even people who have never seen it, I've never seen Dallas.
Oh, really?
I grew up in Dallas and I've been to, you know, South Fork Ranch.
Matthew, you grew up in Dallas and you never watched Dallas?
No, what? But I've actually been to South Fork Ranch a bunch of times.
Oh, so you've just reenacted Dallas.
Yes, exactly. I just play acted that I was JR. No. but, you know, it's incredible because I think even for people who haven't seen it, we understand that reference, you know, the idea of the cliffhanger. And I think Dallas was one of the biggest shows at the time, but it also really set the standard for an incredible cliffhanger that made you have to come back, which I don't know if anything ever got bigger than that. Next, I think maybe the next biggest one was probably The Next Generation with what happens, but you know, with Picard.
I think so. That's my feeling anyway.
It's pretty incredible to think that, you know, it took that long to create another cliffhanger. And, you know, I mean, nowadays we have so many shows that have cliffhangers all the time. So it's you know, neither here nor there. But I mean, that was, to be a part of that, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, it really is. So that's Dallas. And then the other show that he's really known for, and this one, I guess, is the biggest one, at least in the eyes of some in terms of his role in it, was Family Matters, 1990 to 92. He played Lieutenant Murtaugh. And if you go and look at IMDb, at Barry Jenner's page, they say known for Family Matters and Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Two completely different types of shows.
Exactly.
Oh, man.
Although Deep Space Nine is kind of about a family. So
this
a
is
family
true.
On
this
station.
Is true. So
you've got your crazy Uncle Gowron. You've got your evil cousin Dukat. You know, you've got your sleazy, slimy Uncle Quark.
Yeah.
He's actually good-hearted, but doesn't like to let people know.
Dirty Uncle Quark is a classic. So, I agree with you. It is funny that he came in on Deep Space Nine, you know, and obviously very late in the series, and yet plays such a pivotal role. And of course, on Family Matters, completely different, you know, starting with the show then. But it really is two shows about a strange kind of family mixture, you know, and I think that's one of those things about television that's been really interesting is how much of it is about families or found families, you know, and it's been that way for a very long time. And we tend to really like those kinds of stories. And one, it's interesting, like you said, you know, Deep Space Nine is not just about found families, but it's also about family because we have a lot of family elements to the show, like the O'Briens, the Siskos, and others. And so I think that's a really interesting thing to see that they were able to put both of those things together in Star Trek Deep Space Nine in a way that really hadn't been seen ever in Star Trek. So really breaking a lot of barriers in that way, and he gets to be a part of that.
Well, I will say Deep Space Nine doesn't have as many family elements as Season 7 of The Next Generation, Matthew. Let's bring every crew member's family members.
That is true. That is true. Where it's gonna, we're gonna bring Troy's mom back. We're gonna bring Alexander back. We're gonna bring back, you know,
George. Let's bring Data's mother and find out that she's also an android and doesn't know it.
Yep. Yeah. So that's when you start.
Let's go camping on the holodeck with Worf's brother.
Back to Deep Space Nine, Chris. Back to Deep Space Nine.
Well, a little more info about Barry Jenner before we talk about his role in Deep Space Nine. He was born on January 14th, 1941 in Philadelphia. And this is something that I did not know about him, that his occupation prior to acting was a police officer. He was reserve officer for 21 years with the Los Angeles Police Department. And then he got into acting.
That makes a lot of sense. You can see that kind of demeanor. Maybe must be why he was really able to pull off that role as an admiral, of that authority figure, just immediately.
Yeah, I was thinking about that too, because as I said, I did not know this about him until I started doing a little research after he passed away. And then in preparation for this, I of course was not able to go back and watch all 12 episodes that he was in, but I did skim through a lot of them to just watch his scenes and see how he played the character and how he interacted with Sisko and the others, and Kira as well, because there's that whole plot line at the beginning of Season 7 where he goes to the station while Sisko is away and he has to deal with Kira being in command and has that tension there, you know, between what Starfleet needs and then what Bajor wants. And so I was watching how he played the role, and then knowing that he had this background as a police officer actually does make it interesting to see how he plays the role. And he does bring, and it's something that I want to talk about in a moment, he does bring a very different approach to the position of admiral compared with what we had seen earlier in Star Trek, particularly on The Next Generation.
I would say he's probably the only admiral that I can think of that's not a badmiral.
Yeah, it does feel that way. Before we talk about that, though, his cause of death, when I heard that he had passed away, my first reaction was, no way, he's so young. He's not quite as young as I thought he was. He was 75, which these days is still quite young. I, for some reason, maybe because I'm always watching Deep Space Nine, and so we're always seeing a snapshot of Barry Jenner as he was in the 90s, I was feeling like he was quite a bit younger than that. But 75 is still quite young, and very unfortunate that he was taken away from us at that age. But he died of acute myeloid leukemia, and he died on August 9th at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles. And he left behind, of course, his wife and two children.
It is interesting that you mentioned that about the idea that we always kind of think of these characters as they were, you know, captured on screen. And it is kind of funny because I catch myself with that a lot of times with a lot of the actors on any show, you know, that you rewatch a bunch. And in fact, even just going back, say, a year or two on a show that's, you know, still on the air, like Arrow or Flash or something, you go back to the first season of that, something like that, and you see those characters and you're like, oh wow, they really, you've seen the aging process when you see them now. And the same thing with like Deep Space Nine, you know, any of them, you kind of think of them in your mind as who they were as that character, but then you see them now and you're like, oh yeah, that much time has passed, goodness, I can't believe it.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Jenner on Deep Space Nine and his role there. As we've already mentioned, he was in 12 episodes, and that is from the beginning of Season 6 all the way to the end of Season 7. So we first see him in A Time to Stand, then Behind the Lines, Favor the Bold, and then there's this long gap through Season 6 where we don't see him. He is referenced a couple of times, and then we see him again in Tears of the Prophets. Then, Season 7, he's in Image in the Sand, Shadows and Symbols, Inter Arma Enum Silent Legis, Till Death Do Us Part, The Changing Face of Evil, When It Rains, The Dogs of War, and What You Leave Behind. So he does play a key role there, of course. as the war winds down at the end of the series, he was referenced in Sons and Daughters, The Reckoning, and The Emperor's New Cloak. So he actually gets a reference in a Mirror Universe episode as well. But Matthew, I guess my question to you would be how you feel about his portrayal of Admiral Ross and also what Admiral Ross brought to the show and the lives of our characters on the show, in particular Sisko. And we mentioned already a bit about his, about the fact that he's maybe the only admiral in our eyes who's not a badmiral. It really stands out to me that he was the first admiral that came aboard a ship or the station who really seemed to not be there to be the authority figure from up on high at Starfleet Command, but actually came to try to understand the people who were really working in the field.
I completely agree with that, Chris. And I think the thing that stands out to me most about Barry Jenner and Admiral Ross is what Barry Jenner, I think, brings to the role. There's something about the way that he plays it, which is, he is somebody in authority, but he doesn't come in lording his authority over people in the way that a lot of the other admirals we've seen, like Nechayev or somebody else like that, where it's just, it's do what I say because I'm in, I'm ahead of you in the command structure or else. You know, that's kind of the feeling you always got from these admirals. Whereas Admiral Ross was this guy who almost seems like a mentor figure to Sisko in a lot of ways. You know, he came along and, you know, anytime he was asking him to do something, I feel it's because he was seeing potential in Sisko as a leader and kind of understood Sisko in a way that a lot of the other admirals didn't and was really able to work with him in such a key way. I mean, when I think about the fact, the way that they work together at the beginning of season 6, he's able to take Sisko away from a place that he's comfortable, but also put him in a job that he's very good at, which is to see the big picture and help take back Deep Space Nine in the end. But it's Sisko's mind that I think Ross really recognizes, you know, this guy has something that is more than just being the captain of a, you know, space station. He's got the kind of mind that we could use it, maybe in the Admiralty one day. And so I think that's the thing that I really like about him as the character. And I think Barry Jenner just brings all of that with him in his portrayal of Admiral Ross. I think he does a lot of things that maybe the writers didn't even have an idea of until he started portraying the role. And I don't know, it just makes it a much more comfortable role to watch, you know? I don't think I ever feel like any of the other admirals we see, I ever want them to be on screen anymore. I'm like, go away as fast as possible, you know? Whereas with Admiral Ross and Barry Jenner, I'm like, I wish he almost was on the show more. He was fantastic.
Yeah. Well, I think that he feels more like a real person. Well, yes. He does feel like a real person. I shouldn't even say more like a real person. He feels like a real person, whereas normally the admirals don't.
They kind of feel like talking heads, which they usually are. You know, they're just on screen.
They really do.
Yeah.
When we look at someone like Admiral Whatley in Rapture.
Yeah.
When we talked about Rapture recently, I mentioned that he sort of pulls me out of the episode a little bit because he doesn't feel like a real person at all. He doesn't have any interest really in who Sisko is or what the situation is. And the actor, in fact, Ernest Perry Jr., in this particular role, felt like he was simply reading lines, like it was the first time he had been handed the script. You know, it just didn't work.
Yeah, he feels, and I don't really love the word wooden, but he does feel pretty wooden in his delivery. You know, Admiral Ross, I think, and the way that Jenner plays him, like you said, it feels authentic and organic. It feels like a real person in a lot of ways. And I think the way that he plays the role is sympathetic and at the same time authoritative, which is very, yeah. I think, difficult to do, and something, you know, part of it is that we get to see more of the character in the first place, because he's going to be more a part of the story, because Deep Space Nine doesn't do that thing where you just bring somebody in and then shuffle them off to the side. We make them part of the things, and so we get to know this character better. But again, it was one of those points where you wanted more of the character because you liked him and you wanted to know more about him, and you wanted to, I think, have him even maybe be in more storylines. They could have, you know, mm-hmm. Deep Space Nine is definitely a show they could have gone on with after, you know. We talked about Star Trek The Next Generation kind of feeling a little bit tired by season 7, whereas I think Deep Space Nine didn't feel like that at all.
No.
Because it had been re-energized with the new Dax, and it had some incredible stories it still could have been telling, even into a season. I mean, you could have done at least 10 seasons, I think, of that show, and it not
you could have done
tired.
The post-war story.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Right. There's all sorts of stuff you could have done there. You mentioned that Ross seemed like a mentor to Sisko, but when I watch some of those scenes, I agree with that, but when I watch some of those scenes, I also think, in a way, you could say that Sisko was a bit of a mentor to Ross as well, because being in the field and actually seeing what Sisko has to deal with, and having... I mean, there is a point where Ross tells him, you know, you have to be a Starfleet captain or the emissary. But that's sort of the Starfleet position that Ross is delivering. Ross himself, I think, understood that Sisko was torn between these two worlds actually had an interest in what was happening in Sisko's life. And I think also was learning some about the world beyond the Admiralty, I suppose.
Well, I mean, I don't know how many other captains that they end up with in Star Trek and in the Federation that people have associated with being some sort of deity, basically, on a planet like this, in a way in which the people on that planet readily accept them because it's part of their religion, and he's wrapped up in that religion and these aliens. I mean, it's just one of the most unique situations that we've ever seen in Star Trek, and that's what makes it so interesting to be able to dive into and continually talk about. But I think for Admiral Ross, he understood that. This is one of the most unique things that we've ever dealt with, you know, and walking the line between that, I think, like you said, he, more than any of the other admirals that we see, understands, because he gets to know Sisko, the tightrope that Sisko's had to walk. And at the same time, he seems more open-minded to the idea that maybe there's something out there, there's something to this. You know, it's not just, you know, hocus pocus.
Right. Another question for you that plays into why maybe he was receptive to things that other admirals weren't is the fact that he had some sympathy anyway towards Section 31, and he actually worked with Section 31 as part of really getting the Romulans into the war in Inter Arma and Silent Legus. You know, he actually helps an agent infiltrate the conference on Romulus, and he actually undermines Bashir at that point, and then he has this lecture from Bashir, and Ross actually justifies his actions in doing this in a way that I think is real world, and it's not necessarily something that would have been presented in earlier Star Trek, but the fact that, as he quotes the Roman philosopher Cicero, in times of war, laws fall silent, which is what the title of the episode means. And what do you think about an admiral who comes in and is instrumental to the war effort, but has the sympathy towards Section 31?
I think what it is doing is it allows Deep Space Nine to be able to, like you said, be a little bit more realistic. You know, we put the Alpha Quadrant in a situation where everything they hold dear is on the line. What do you do? How do you do it? And I think back to the idea that, like, say, even in the American Civil War, a lot of people don't realize or know that there were plenty of places in which some of the things that Abraham Lincoln himself did, people might not agree with now, in the way that he silenced certain people in the press and that kind of stuff. And so I think we sometimes whitewash history.
Yeah.
Either that, or we just say, we get on our high horse and say, oh, well, we would never do that again. Whereas if you really knew, stuff's happening all the time that you don't know about. Mm-hmm. So what I really like is the reality to the situation, and the more idealistic idea from Bashir, or the more pragmatic of Admiral Ross. But at the same time, you have to think, you know, Admiral Ross knows 1,000 times more about exactly what's going on in this war and how close they may be to losing it. So I think it's very interesting, and it creates so much good conversation. And I like that the point of that episode is to give you two points of view, and they're not telling you which one's right.
Right.
Because by this point, you've made Ross to be a likable enough character to where the person watching the episode, they may side with him. You know, they may not side with Bashir in this one. So I think that's what makes it really interesting to see.
Well, it's like Sisko in The Pale Moonlight as well.
Oh, yeah, right?
He
exactly.
has to do something that you may not agree with, but because you know the character so well, you can understand his position, and maybe you can accept it even if you think the actions were wrong. It's interesting that you mentioned that Ross has so much more knowledge and understands so much better the reality of what's going on and the intricacy of the diplomatic situation and pulling forces together and what it takes to win the war, compared with Bashir at this point in the series, where he represents, and I would need to go back and rewatch that episode in order to definitively say what I think about this, but just on the surface level, I think Bashir represents the analytical, by the numbers, sort of academic view of the world, which we see a lot where people think that the world should fit into this nice, neat box based on theories and discussions that they might have in university. And the real world isn't like that. And Bashir has his position because at this point, you know, he's doing all these calculations. We have the storylines where he's at one point even suggesting that the Federation surrender because mathematically it would make more sense for them to surrender to avoid a certain number of deaths. And so you have that sort of view versus Ross's view of, well, look, in time of war, this is what you have to do in order to ultimately win the war and avoid unnecessary deaths and preserve the way of life that we're trying to preserve. It can be messy sometimes.
Right. And what's so interesting when you think about it is that Ross's view is very Vulcan. The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few or the one. So few deaths to save millions and or billions, what we're talking about, on the scales of justice, how do we weigh that? And I think, you know, that utilitarian argument is something that is very strong, because I think for the majority of people, when you think of it in that way, you're like, oh, yeah, which is kind of the danger of only being utilitarian in your philosophy. And now we're getting into Metatrex. But I think that's one of the strengths of the episode is that, it, like you said, it's showing two different ways. But I also think it's very important when you think about it today. Bashir is that person who has a narrative in his head about how things should be. And he's going to stick to that, whether that jives with the facts and the truth of something. And I think that's pretty huge. And so because Ross is in a place with facts and figures and the truth of the situation and not just what he wants something to be. Like, the world is not what we want it to be all the time. or right. ever, really. So we have to deal with it as it is. And, you know, that's where trying to work our best ideals out in that come into play. And that's what Deep Space Nine, I think, is really all about, is how do we work out our best ideals in the real world?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And to bring this back around to Barry Jenner, what makes all this work, I think, is how Barry Jenner portrays Ross. As we said earlier, he feels like a real person. Just like Sisko feels like a real person. You know, what Avery Brooks brings to that role, it's Sisko is Avery Brooks, in a way. And when you have someone playing off of him in Barry Jenner, who also has that genuine feeling that you feel like you're watching these two men, and then bring J.G. Hertzler in when you have the scenes of Sisko and Ross and Martok together, the three of them together, you really feel these are three real people who are making hard decisions and supporting each other, and they don't always agree completely, but they're going to work together. And the fact that Barry Jenner was able to bring that to the role of a Starfleet admiral in a way that we had really never seen before was just absolutely critical. And that's why I think Barry Jenner was critical to the Deep Space Nine story.
And what Barry Jenner was able to do with that role in conjunction, like you were saying, with Avery Brooks as Sisko and J.G. Hertzler as Martok, is give us that kind of band of leaders aspect that mm-hmm. we've never seen in Star Trek, where you see the people who are actually making the decisions above the captaincy. You know, because Sisko, he becomes an adjunct to the admiral. So he is at a higher level. He's getting more intelligence. He's getting the opportunity to make much larger plans and being entrusted with a lot more than just a space station, but an entire sector of space that he's responsible mm-hmm. for. So I think that's a really neat thing that this character and his portrayal really brought into it. And one of the things that you put on here, Chris, that I really liked was, and I think it's one of the clearest examples of how Barry Jenner actually impacted the role personally as an actor in Shadows and Symbols, that Iris Uvenbear was observing the actors running through some scenes, and the scene he was watching was where Ross tells Kira he won't support her if she attacks the Romulans, and that afterwards Ira came over to Jenner and was asking about how he was playing the role. And he said, you know, I wanted to try and make it seem as though Ross has regret that he can't back Kira. And what I love is Ira saying, I never thought of putting that into mm-hmm. the scene, but Jenner did. And I think that's the clearest example I can see, and I think it really speaks to everything we've been saying about him as an actor, is that he just brought something different because he made this character a real living, breathing person that he, it seems like in his mind, reading through the lines, spending some time thinking about who is this character, what is his motivation, all of that kind of stuff, really bringing some method to the acting here that changed our perception of what an admiral is in Star Trek. And I think that's fantastic. I really, really like that. And I think it just is the reason why he becomes a character that I would love to have had more of because of what he brought to the role.
Yeah, I think at that point, Ira and the rest of the writers realized that they could do more with the character.
Most definitely.
And that he could play strength and also show a different level of emotion in the situation by feeling like, I wish I could support Kira, but I can't because my position is I'm a Starfleet admiral and we need the Romulans. And so they knew that he wouldn't seem weak if they had him back down.
Well, strength and empathy. No, I think that's just an incredible part about the character. And I think, you know, the fact that we get this insight into what an admiral is like, I think it's actually transferring into some of the things that they're doing in the literature right now, you know, with Admiral Riker. Riker's been made an admiral, and I see him in that same mold, you know, as the Admiral Ross. And I think Admiral Ross has given the writers an opportunity to kind of see, how do you make an admiral likable? You know, even when, and this is one of the most interesting, we're used to the captain being the one having to make the tough calls. But when you think about adding the whole extra layer of being the admiral, like, your decisions are affecting so much more than just you and your ship and your crew. They're usually affecting entire sectors of space, if not maybe the entire Federation at large, you know? So, I mean, it's, I think it starts here, though, with Ross, and that all goes back, as we keep saying, to Jenner and his performance. And that is something that can never be taken away, and I think just will continue to speak to Star Trek fans over and over again as they watch through Deep Space Nine, as new people find Deep Space Nine. Hopefully, you know, Chris, they'll fall in love with the character as much as we have.
Yeah. Great character, and wow. Yeah, just the ensemble cast they were able to put together and all the extras was just amazing on DS9. And I'm just very grateful for Barry Jenner for bringing his talents to the show and giving us Admiral Ross and giving us a good moral for
a good moral. That's right. I love it.
All right. Well, I'm glad we got to talk about Barry Jenner for a bit here. And down the road, I don't know, we might delve into Admiral Ross again when we're not doing a memorial.
Yeah. You know, Chris, I was thinking that it seems like we need to go and watch that Inner Arma episode.
Yeah. And yeah, I think we should. We should
and
do that
really soon. Dive into that, because I think, you know, that's just one of those episodes. It's like, yeah, we're talking about just one specific episode, but there's so much to dive into that really drives at the heart of the philosophy of Deep Space Nine, to where it's bigger. So yeah, hopefully in a few weeks we can dive into that sometime. I think that would be fantastic, and
yeah,
a great way to continue to pay homage to a man and a character to which we lost.
Yeah, most definitely. So that will be coming up down the road. We'll do that. Also, I want to mention as we wrap up here that the next episode we're going to do is an Orb of Mail, because we haven't done an Orb of Mail in a while. So if you want to share your thoughts on Barry Jenner, that would be an excellent chance for you to do that. And of course, if you have other questions about the show, meaning the Orb, things we've talked about, or the show, meaning Deep Space Nine, things that you want to hear our thoughts on, be sure to send us those things over the coming week. And you can do that on Twitter. Our username is TrekFM. You can do it in the Babel Conference on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field if you're not already a member, and it will come up. It is a closed group, so you'll need to click join and we'll let you in. Or send us a voicemail at speakpipe.com/TrekFM, and we'd love to hear your voice there. Remembering Barry Jenner isn't the only thing we've been doing on Trek FM recently, though. So here's a quick look at some of our other shows.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
I saw most of the original series with my grandfather between the age of like 2 and 5. So a lot of my early, early impressions are based on, can a 2 or 5-year-old basically sit through an episode and find something they like in it? Okay, Kirk is running around like a horse, which is kind of fun, I guess.
Standard Orbit.
When it was asked of him if he would be in a role or would be willing to take a role of Captain Kirk, he has come to grips with the fact he is too old to do any of that stuff. And it just wouldn't work, which I thought was very telling. And a great joke about Leonard Nimoy. You know, it's one thing when you go back in time and you still find yourself being old.
Yeah.
That means you're really old.
That was a good line.
That was a good line.
Meta Trex.
The only thing it was missing was a Geordi PowerPoint.
Yeah, about the closest thing we have to a Geordi PowerPoint in Star Trek Beyond, Mike, is Spock trying to point out the location of Uhura's radioactive tracking device necklace.
He gave her a radio tracking device necklace.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find us everywhere you get your podcasts. iTunes is probably the best place because we are a featured content provider with Apple. You can find our artist section there in the iTunes store if you go to itunes.com/TrekFM. That's itunes.com/TrekFM. If you're an Android user, you can also find us on Google Play Music. Just search for Trek.fm or our shows in your Google Play Music app, and those should come up. And you can find us pretty much anywhere you get podcasts as well. Just search for us and you'll probably find us. And then our website is at trek.fm, where you can stream from the show pages and download the MP3 files. So Matthew, if people want to share their thoughts with you on Barry Jenner or anything else about Star Trek, or follow along with all the other great things you talk about here on the network, where should they go?
Well, Chris, I just feel like I'm all over the place, but one of the best places is Twitter, at MattRushing02. Of course, I do find myself on the Babel Conference a lot, so check me out under any of the shows that I do, you know, Literary Treks, or, of course, the 602 Club. Love doing those shows. Fantastic, both of them. So you can always find me talking about those. As well as I have my own personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. And then I have another podcast I do with John Mills, which is called Aggressive Negotiations. And that's on iTunes. And it's a Star Wars podcast. It's a lot of fun. We just kind of choose a fun topic from Star Wars and talk about it that week. So I hope you'll check that out. And Chris, I know that you are all over the interwebs. In your busy schedule, you still find a time to tweet and talk and all that kind of stuff. So if people want to talk to you about some of the things that they loved about Barry Jenner or Deep Space Nine, where can they find you?
Yeah, I do find time to talk a little bit on social media. So you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. You can also find me there in the Babel Conference, and C. Brian Jones is my username pretty much everywhere. And then you can find me elsewhere on the network doing the Ready Room, where we talk about all 5 live-action Star Trek series. We rotate through those, and we also have a news segment. And you can find my writing about Star Trek on the official website at StarTrek.com. So Matthew, I'd like to take a moment, as we always do, and thank our associate producers here on The Orb: Ruth Ward, Ken Tripp, William Murray, and Kay Elizabeth Janeway. Thank you so much, Ruth, Ken, William, and Kay, for your support. And also Norm Lau, who many people know has stepped down from some of his roles on the network as he transitions into a very busy time in his life, but he is now an associate producer across the entire network. So thank you also to Norm for all of his help on the network. And we really could not do it without all of you guys. If you'd like to become an associate producer or just help out in other ways, help us keep the network going, you can do that through Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm. Everything that you need to know is right there on that site. And the support that we get there through Patreon helps us pay for the cost of production, hosting, distribution, and other things related to putting the shows together and getting them out there to you. We really cannot do this without your support, so I hope you'll check that out, patreon.com/trekfm. And another way that you can help us is to pick up some great Trek FM merchandise at trekfm.store. That's the URL, trekfm.store. We have all kinds of great designs that are available as t-shirts and pillows and stickers and notebooks and all kinds of different merchandise over there. Check that out. Most of the money goes to producing the items and getting them to you, but we do get a little bit from that, and it does help out. Plus, you get some really cool designs by our art director, Aaron Harvey. So, again, the URL for that is trekfm.store.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and we will see you next time as we gaze into the orb.